final speaker today is Becky Pettit. Becky is a professor of sociology at the University of Texas at Austin. She earned her PhD in sociology from Princeton, and previously she served on the faculty of University of Washington. She's trained in demographic methods with interest in social inequality broadly defined. She'll present her data from her newest book, Invisible Men, Mass Incarceration and the Myth of Black Progress, published by Russell Sage Foundation in 2012, which investigates how decades of growth in America's prisons and jails obscures basic accounts of racial inequality.
Thanks to everybody for coming. Thanks to Catherine for organizing the session, and to Nancy for putting this all together, and the spirit of 1848. So I'm really happy to be here and to have the opportunity to think a little bit more about the implications of my work and the work that I've done for the study of health and health inequalities. I'm just going to say from the outset, I would say that the biggest shortcoming of my book, Invisible Men, was about thinking about health inequalities, and partly because I think where I was at the time, we just didn't have the data to answer the kind of questions that I had. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I'm thinking now, and I think really raise some questions for future research, my own and hopefully that of other people. So the title of the book, Invisible Men, came from a puzzle. I was working with a postdoc at the time. His name is Brian Sykes. He's now in the faculty of University of California, Irvine. And Brian and I were trying to estimate the lifetime risk of spending at least a year in a federal or state prison. This is something that Bruce Western and I had done about 10 years earlier, and so we were just trying to update this. And what we found was we found more young black men with less than a high school diploma had been to prison than were alive. So that is, we found a lifetime risk greater than one. How could that possibly be? How could that possibly be? So, you know, we wondered about that. That is essentially the puzzle that then motivated the book, which is that we were able to observe these young men in prison or jail, and we weren't able to observe them in other national data collection systems. And the risk of incarceration has grown so dramatically, and it's so disproportionately concentrated among those with young men of color with low levels of education, that this fundamentally distorts patterns of inequality. And so those are the puzzles that essentially motivated the book. And the fundamental claim that I make is that our national data systems and the social facts they produce are based on a normative kind of economic and domestic life, one stably situated in households. So I just want to walk through a little bit of the historical origins of why I think we are where we are. So we are constitutionally mandated to collect data about the population every 10 years through the decennial census. That is our constitutional mandate, and that is for one sole purpose, which is for for congressional reapportionment. But we collect data for lots of different reasons. And we've changed what data we collect and how we collect it over the course of American history. And so I would say one of the radical shifts in American data collection happened in the mid-1800s, 1850, 1860. Prior to, in 1865, this is a photo of America's first land-grant college, Iowa State University. In 1865, at the height of the Civil War, President Lincoln signed the Morrill Act. The Morrill Act provided land grants to states for colleges and universities. It was at a historic time of rapid social and economic change, and part of the Morrill Act was exactly designed to open up economic opportunity, to expand education to those who otherwise might not have had access to it, and in order to facilitate this, the federal government needed more information about the needs and capacities of the population than it had previous. So they needed information about what were the educational levels of the population, what were the economic capacities of the population, what sort of skills and capacities did the population have, and might we want to grow. So around in the 1850 census, the 1860 census, there was an expansion to collect more information about the needs and capacities of the population. Exactly in relation to the designs of federal policy. During the height of the Depression in the 1930s, there was quite a debate between the Hoover and Roosevelt administration, or at the early part, Hoover and Roosevelt administrations, about exactly the depths and distribution of poverty. We had information from the 1930 census. We were going to have information from the 1940 census. But in 1931, 32, what exactly was the unemployment rate? How was it distributed across the population? Who was most at risk and most in need? And this is, we knew a lot from the work of urban ethnographers, from small-scale studies, from WPA photographers like Dorothea Lang, but we didn't know at the national level about the size, density, and distribution of poverty, unemployment. So at a time of radical federal legislative change, the Social Security Act of 1935, we needed to collect more information exactly to allocate those new federal resources to states and localities. So what did we do? We designed what was then called the Sample Survey of Unemployment, which was a sample survey of individuals living in households, which was going to be conducted monthly. The first survey was collected in 1939. In 1942, it was transferred to the Census Bureau. In 1947, it became the current population survey. So when you hear the unemployment rate is 5.9%, those data come from the current population survey, which is a monthly survey of 50 to 60,000 individuals living in households. And those data are used to gauge the economic and social well-being of the American population. We've essentially been collecting the data the same way since 1939. I just want to say it's current population survey. As much as we've been talking about updating categories on the Census Bureau or on the decennial census, the fundamental sampling frame that we use for most of the surveys that we collect in this country uses the household as the sampling unit. So there was a radical expansion of America's data, I call it the data collection apparatus, between 1935 and 1965, at which time LBJ is signing the amendment to the Social Security Act, the Medicare amendment. The sample survey of unemployment became the CPS in 1947. The National Health Interview Survey was instituted in 1957. The National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey was instituted in 1959. LBJ signed the Medicare Amendment in 1965, which led to the establishment of Medicare and Medicaid. The National Survey of Drug Use, these might be familiar to you. I don't know exactly what surveys you all use in your work, but the National Survey of Drug Use was instituted in 1971. The Medical Expenditure Panel was instituted in 1977. The CPS was expanded in 1981 to include questions on health insuredness. There's been quite a lot of change in that over the last few years, but there is you can look at time trends in health insuredness using current population survey since 1981. All of these surveys use the household as the sampling frame. So all of these surveys draw their samples from individuals living in households. Why is that a problem? Well, this is a photograph of President Obama swearing to uphold the Constitution on January 20th of 2009, at which time political pundits, scholars, and a whole bunch of other people made claims about living in a post-racial America. At this time, there were 2.3 million Americans living in prisons and jails, invisible, not included in the sampling frames of any household surveys. They are disproportionately male, they are disproportionately black, and they have disproportionately low levels of education. And that means, a very simple statistical observation, there is acute sample bias in almost all of the surveys we use as social scientists, as public health researchers, as policymakers, to frame our understanding of racial inequality in America. So a lot of people say, oh, well, it's 1%. It's just 1% of the population. At the time, it was 2.3, just over 2.3 million Americans at the time of Obama's inauguration. It's now just under 2.3 million Americans are incarcerated. The peak of incarceration in this country was year-end 2008. We've seen some decline. Some of that is, in four major states for very different reasons. But we have about 1% of the American adult population incarcerated. You know, from a sample selection problem, you might say, oh, if it's 1%, if that's randomly distributed across the population, it's not a problem. It's not randomly distributed across the population. Just like 1%, the top 1% of wealth holders in this country are not randomly distributed. So instead of focusing attention on the top 1%, I'm focusing attention on the bottom 1%. And it has acute implications for how we understand inequality. So among African American men who've dropped out of high school, over 35% of them are incarcerated on any given day. I just want to let that sink in. 35%. So this is not equally distributed across the population. What does that mean? Okay, so I'm going to give you one example that I've talked a lot about, and I think it really illustrates this very nicely, what the implications are for how we understand inequality. So, okay, this is 2008. The peak of incarceration, the numbers have changed a little bit since then. I'm happy to talk about that later or offline sometime. But and I also want to, I need to attribute a lot of the credit to this to my collaborator, Brian Sykes. So we've done a lot of work since focused on this and other outcomes. Okay, so if we think about the data that come from the current population survey, in 2008, we would estimate a high school dropout rate of 7.2% among this group of non-Hispanic whites and 13.5% of non-Hispanic blacks. If we adjust that to include inmates, now among all groups of inmates, all sociodemographic groups of inmates, inmates have lower levels of education than the household-based population. So this is a simple adjustment we make by pooling data from the inmate population that comes from the total counts of inmates, weighted by surveys of information from the surveys of inmates, which are conducted periodically, with that of the household population from the current population survey. So if you create an adjustment, you find an adjustment of 8%. So 8% of non-Hispanic whites didn't finish high school in this group, and almost 1 in 5 non-Hispanic blacks didn't finish high school. The difference is 11% for non-Hispanic whites and 41% for non-Hispanic blacks. I asked my undergraduates, if the person sitting next to you is making 41% more than you and they're doing the same work, is that a lot? They all feel very strongly about this, as you might imagine. But, you know, so that's one way of thinking about a lot. The magnitude is really big here, I think. But also, it changes what the claims we would make about racial inequality. There are a lot of people, smart people, using data from the CPS that have made the claim that racial inequality in high school and the high school dropout rate has narrowed over time. Now, certainly there was this, and this is a solid line, the lower solid line, which shows that there's a decline in the racial gap in high school completion or in high school dropout from 1980, and one might argue even into the 2000s. So at the time of the Obama election, people were saying, oh, it's going away. These are smart people. And if you include inmates in these calculations, you see no improvement in the high school dropout rate among young black men or in the racial gap in high school dropout rates since at least the early 1990s. And actually, you see some increase in racial inequality in the gap. That's the dotted line. So it's about 13%, as it was about 25 years ago. To think about how long that's been is sort of striking to me. Okay, so why does this matter for healthcare? I've mentioned all the surveys that I think are potentially flawed because of it. So in 2010, President Barack Obama signed the Affordable Care Act, promising to expand healthcare access to, at the time, I think the estimate was 50 million American adults without insurance. So this is just a figure, I pulled it right out of the CPS document, that shows, using data from the current population survey, that shows the number of insured over time. The peak was in 2010. It was about 50 million. It looked like it fell a little bit since then to 48. The uninsured rate peaked at 16% at about the same time and fell to 15.4% in 2012. well, what's the rate for among these groups that I've been focusing a lot of attention on, and what does it mean that we're missing a third, more than a third of young black men who dropped out of high school from our surveys? Okay, so I actually have the numbers, but I didn't want to put them up because I don't want to be quoted on these. But just to sort of look at this, and I have to credit Carmen Gutierrez, a graduate student at University of Texas who's been helping me with some of this work. So if we look at the percentage of men 18 to 64 without health insurance in 2010, and this is almost exactly at the same time that Obama signed the law because the data were collected in March. Okay, so we actually find among men in uninsured rates are much higher. And there's a gradient by race and education. So, you know, among non-Hispanic black men, these are 18 to 64-year-olds. We have a quarter of those with less than a high school diploma, 34% of those with high school diploma, and 23% of those with some college who don't have insurance. So I just want to just say one puzzle. Why is it that young men, white and black, who have less than a high school diploma have lower rates of uninsuredness than those who have a high school diploma or more? Okay, I'm going to answer that question, which is I think part of it is because there's sample selectivity in who's actually capturing these surveys. And so that we don't see the most disadvantaged segments of the population. That raises another puzzle, though, which is when men are incarcerated, they actually have health care coverage. Now, a variable quality, we might say, we can, and California's in a lot of trouble for this, but I think this raises a lot of questions about how many people are really at risk of being uninsured and how might we better cover them. Okay, so I just want to show this. This is the group that I focus most of my attention on, which is young men between the ages of 20 and 34. These are the guys that are most at risk of incarceration. So among, and this is in 2010, which is actually not the peak, but for non-Hispanic white men, for those with less than a high school diploma, 46% didn't have insurance, and for non-Hispanic black men, 49% didn't have insurance, and I would claim that's an underestimate. For high school, it's actually lower in both groups, and then lower again for those with some college. I find these patterns very interesting to think about and to think about how to design some research questions about them, but I just want to say one thing. So I did these analyses. If we look at, say, including inmates, we find no improvement in the high school dropout rate since the 1990s for young black men. We find that young black men without a high school diploma are more likely to be in prison or jail than they are to be employed. And we actually find employment rates comparable to or worse than they were pre-civil rights. I'm not the only one who's found this. Derek Neal has also done some very similar work. And I would submit that if we sort of think about the incarcerated population as a pool of essentially healthcare uninsured, if they were out, I would submit they're very likely to be uninsured from all the evidence we know, that we would have uninsurance rates among non-Hispanic black men of close to 3/4, 75%, right, because of the sample selectivity. That's what the numbers suggest, right? If you got 35, it's a simple math problem. If you got 35% of the population that you're missing, and we assume none of them are insured, then we have a pretty big inflation factor here. So, what does this mean? This means, what are the implications of this for the studies of health and healthcare? CPS underestimates the total number of at risk of what I think of as uninsuredness. Sample bias also underestimates racial inequality in uninsuredness. Because exactly there's huge racial inequality in exposure to the criminal justice system. But I started by saying, you know, I think one of the biggest shortcomings of my work has been not looking at some of these healthcare measures, and I think part of it is because there's really mixed effects on studies of other health and healthcare outcomes because of the healthcare provision while people are in prison or jail. And what I'm interested in particularly in what happens when they get out, right? If they then join the ranks of the uninsured. And depending on states' expansion of Medicaid through ACA, there might be wild variability in how this is handled across states. Just a little foreshadowing where we might go later. So what does this all mean, all of it together? Prison and jail is normative in some social and demographic groups. Inmates are excluded from surveys that draw samples from household population, and I named some of them. There are more. Almost all surveys, unless they say cohort in them, draw their samples from individuals living in households. And excluding inmates from surveys overstates progress and obscures portraits of and explanations for inequality. And I think fundamentally then it makes it extremely challenging to think about targeting solutions. I want to say one last thing, which is that this mass incarceration, the massive buildup of the prison and jail system, has not been coupled with increases in crime. There's been a radical departure of incarceration from crime since at least the early 1990s. So crime is actually at historic lows. It's at about the same level it was in the 1960s. And so I see this as the mass incarceration as a radical shift in policy, policing, prosecution, and sentencing that has real consequences on a range of things. But as we as social scientists or public health researchers or policymakers, as we do our research, I think we mean to be very attentive to the sample selection effects of the way in which we collect the data that we have.
Really want to thank our speakers, especially for wonderful talks, but also for staying on time. So we have a good 25 minutes for questions, and I'm sure there's a lot of questions in the audience. We have a mic. If you could come up to the microphone in the middle, would be preferred. Whether or not that the household population truly reflects American households.
so I may make claims about, and people did make claims, about record numbers or record percentages of voter turnout among African Americans, particularly African American men, and particularly those with low levels of education, based on data from the CPS and the National Election Studies that focus on individuals and households. So we've got the denominator wrong, right? Okay, so I think that's the same issue with health. If you want to make claims over time or evaluate the effectiveness of policy, I think we've got to sort of think about continuity and who we're studying, right? We can't just leave out the worst performing students from exams, right? We do, but we anyway, but what I think that it, I think the other thing that just to sort of get with this at risk, what I've observed is that academics are often the last to pick this up. Practitioners know we've got to deal with incarceration. Teachers know we've got to deal with incarceration. People working in clinics on the ground understand this is an issue because 95% of people who go in prison or jail get out, right? And when they get out, they are no longer covered. And often there's a mandated 30-day window where they lose coverage or they lose access to prescriptions. And some of this is easy stuff that this continuity of care could help resolve. Access to mental health care, access to prescriptions, a whole host of other things. So I think, I mean, part of what I'm trying to do is, I mean, yes, they're covered while they're in, but they're often not covered when they get out. And so I think we need to understand this, sort of the life course of spending time in prison or jail, because I suspect many people see it on the ground. HHS understands this is an issue. You know, the Department of Ed understands this is an issue because teachers and practitioners are telling them so.
Nancy Krieger, Harvard School of Public Health. First, I want to just thank all of the presentations, because I think these themes that we've been trying to address with the spirit of 1848 for our 20 years, and I know Catherine will be saying more about this at our celebration tomorrow. But I think the question, I want to point out one thing, which is that the surveys that you're discussing, they're civilian, non-institutionalized populations is the way it's framed. So it's really important to remember the other major institution that's not in there is the military. So, and that matters because that's a different set of selection biases, and also as we move to having, obviously, a quote-unquote
So how do you get people to organize around those biases and say, these people who are socially excluded need to be included, when the people who are socially excluded don't have a voice? It's a really challenging. So I don't really know how to. I mean, your concerns are right on, but I don't know how to advise anybody about, you know, what we need to do next. It's a great thing to think about. So maybe one thing to do, though, would be to precisely point out the political process. Like, we need more research on the politics of the numbers so that people care more about their effects on social policy, on et cetera.
Yeah, and just a quick comment. Just picking up on the, you know, how do we as researchers kind of write about this stuff and think about in our limitations sections, and we can all do, you know, a way better job at that, and that should not be that hard, not to overgeneralize, and in terms of, there's a pedagogical aspect to that. I've tried really hard to teach research methods, and I'm always trying to pound that idea into the students' heads, and they don't get it right away at all. They kind of look at me like, what are you talking about? But I know that eventually they're gonna understand what I'm saying when they, you know, get more into doing more of their own research, but not to overgeneralize. And at the same time, having other types of studies like Beth is doing, for us to have some data on these harder to reach populations and using creative ways of doing the sampling, I think is also important. So we kind of need to do both, I think.
Hi, my name is Maria
Lofton.
I'm a doctoral student at Rutgers University of Chicago. I was interested in the incarceration piece because what I'm trying to understand, I have to write this down because I get kind of nervous when I start talking. But the health insurance, reintegration programs and health coverage are kind of like work hand in hand. So as much as that's an issue, I'm still thinking economically. When you come out of prison, jail, and you can't find a job, most times that has a lot to do with health coverage. And I'm thinking focusing on that because we want to keep people out of prison, out of and going back, the civilization rates decreasing, and we're going to have to really address that and address the issues around access to that and disparities that come with that piece. Because that's clearly, not just with the mass incarceration in blacks, but that's clearly an issue that's racial. So I do understand about the myth of black progress, but I'm also thinking about there's other pieces like father involvement and how some have said, well, there's no black fathers in the home. And then there's research that says they came out with TDC that said that's not true. So it's like how, again, picking back off the data and how we kind of interpret it. So I hope that makes sense.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, that's a really important point. And thanks for the comment. I think there are a growing number of programs focused on reentry and reintegration. And, you know, and I think this is something that actually crosses political lines, where, you know, George W. Bush actually, in, you know, the second to last State of the Union, actually put forward the, I can't remember, Reentry Act or something. My jaw dropped. I was watching it. Second Chance Act, yeah. I mean, a non-trivial amount of money set aside. So I'm currently living in the state of Texas, which I don't think of as the most progressive for criminal justice policy. But actually, they're crossing political lines to focus on decarceration or alternatives to custodial sentences because incarceration has become so expensive. California is federally mandated through the Plata decision to decarcerate. Now, there are a lot of different strategies for that. And New York, I think, is maybe the most progressive in that, you know, New York has alternatives to custodial sentences focused on employment opportunities, drug treatment, mental health care, and other things, particularly for young offenders. So I think there's growing attention, and there's growing attention to reentry. And absolutely, there's a huge focus on jobs. The evidence suggests that ex-offenders who have jobs are much less likely to reoffend than ex-offenders who don't have jobs. And that goes back quite some time, but there's attention to it now. A lot of attention, I think. And there's some think there's an opportunity to think about the whole set of needs that people have that to enable them to be successful upon reentry. Jobs are certainly one. Sometimes that comes with education and training. Healthcare is a huge one. So I think, you know, you're absolutely right. There's a whole bunch of programs that I think are getting more attention and are getting attention across political lines because people are realizing how expensive it is to incarcerate people.
Hi, this is Elaine from RTI International. I have a question for you about your methods. Your methods when you went to folks as people at that from the mobile conference. Did you do the interviews in Spanish? And how did you ask people about their status? And what was the response rate or the participation rate in how many people that you approached didn't want to talk?
Well, the wonderful thing about doing these surveys at the mobile consulates is that by agreement, anybody who's attending a mobile consulate is on their nation's
terrain.
And so they made an agreement with the local police that there would be no surveillance of the survey sites. And so, you know, people who were attending the consulate knew that, and they felt pretty comfortable. The response rate was, you know, there were four of them, but the response rates were in the 90s. I was at Tulane at the time. There's a Latin American Studies Center there, so I had a lot of graduate students who were both Spanish and Portuguese speakers, and I enlisted them. They were very excited to go and do this sort of research, and so I had teams of, it varied how many students were doing the interviews, but we just went up to people as they were standing in line or typically waiting for their documents to be issued, and so they had plenty of time on their hands. And so the response rate was good. People felt comfortable talking to us because we were speaking in their language and their native language, and we were also many of us were white, some were from the countries or from Latin America that they were also from, and so there was some familiarity, but that produced the kind of trust that they felt that they could answer the questions. So the question about status is always the last question on these sorts of surveys, because you want to collect as much information as you can that's comfortable to collect, and then ask the uncomfortable question last. And basically what you do is you start off by saying, you have the list of different types of visas and statuses. Are you a U.S. citizen? Obviously nobody was, because they wouldn't be at the consulate if they were. But then, you know, you go through all of the different legal statuses, and they say, no, I'm not any of those. And then the last option is, would you say you are here without documentation? And, you know, sometimes, very rarely did people refuse to answer that question. And they said, you know, yes, or you could infer it from the fact lack of other legal statuses that they have. So that's how we did it. I used the Mexican Migration Project protocols for the questions, so they're comparable to that. It's a very well-tested study of Mexican migrants. So I think that covers all of your questions. Yeah. By the way, it has been, other people have taken this methodology and used it. I think it's been successful for other purposes as well.
Yeah, I was also curious if it was anonymous or not.
Yes.
Yes, okay. I guess we have time for about maybe one more question. And I was wondering if others had the same question. When I was reviewing the materials on the Census Bureau's presentation, it seemed like they had pretty strong evidence from the 2010 testing about the combined question being much preferred. So I was wondering why they were still going to be doing more research on that, and I was planning on submitting that as a question. And if anybody else had any questions for them, we'd love to hear from you. Yes?
Hi, I'm actually from the National Center for Statistics. but my job specifically is to do question evaluation research, so kind of interviewing and trying to look at the validity and reliability of national surveys. So I guess my question to you, and I'm pretty new to SBHS, and we recently started a health disparities working group to kind of work with some of these issues, especially thinking about the invisible populations that are not counted in these surveys. And I'm just wondering what suggestions or advice would you give, like, say, about the big reading of the census police.
Is that I'm really mindful of the fact that Becky needs to get to the airport, but however, she's quite happy to comment some more. So. Go ahead, quickly.
Well, I just wanted to add one thing, which is that the trend in all of these federal census surveys is that we only ask questions that have some federal mandate associated with them, right? And so
very much. I know we have to let you go. Thanks so much to the speakers as well as your questions, which were excellent.